Thanks so much for joining in on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to talk today to start the show with the folks at the Wisconsin Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection. They work pretty hard to keep you and I safe from fraud, identity theft, and a whole lot more, and certainly grateful to have two of them with us today. Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke. Michelle is the administrator of Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection's service. Michelle, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having us, Larry. We like being here.
Well, Michael Domke is director of the DATCAP's Bureau of Consumer Protection. Michael, good to see you again.
Likewise.
As well.
Good morning, Larry.
And as we talk with Michelle and Michael, we, of course, want to hear from you. Have you received any odd phone calls lately? How are you making sure you stay safe on the Internet? Give us a call. Number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Let's talk. Well, I don't want to talk politics, but there is an election, and a lot of people are getting, including me, are getting bombarded with political texts, calls, and ads. There are some scams involving political action committees, or we call them PACs. Michael, let's turn to you first. What are the requirements for an organization to be an official PAC?
Well, officially, they need to register with the Federal Election Commission, or the FEC, and they will identify what their cause and purpose is, and there's some other background information. And right now, you know, there's thousands of legitimate ones out there, and those are some of the texts and emails that we're getting soliciting, you know, either for funds or to support a certain candidate or a cause.
Well, how are they, the scammers, that is, trying to pretend to be PACs?
Well, you know, just like any legitimate industry or cause, the scammers will try and, you know, pose as being a legitimate PAC supporting legitimate causes or just ones that they make up. And so they'll reach out soliciting those funds. And unfortunately, if you're not careful, those funds don't actually go to a cause. They go to the scammer. And there are a couple telltale things they'll do. One of them is, you know, oftentimes they'll try and solicit donations that are less than $200. And that is by design, because then that will avoid them from having to disclose to the FEC who their donors are. And then, of course, if you find out they're a scam, it makes it difficult for law enforcement to figure out who the victims are and track them down. Another tactic they'll use is they'll offer to match your donation, of course, which seems enticing, and it seems to double the money for the cause. But in reality, they're not doubling anything. They're just keeping the cash.
Yeah. You sometimes hear some celebrity's voice, or you may hear the candidate's voice. What are the laws around using a candidate or a celebrity's voice?
Well, in February of this year, the Federal Communication Commission, or FCC, actually banned robocalls using a tool that will purport to be a fake voice. And, of course, scammers recognize this and, you know, like anything, we don't know if they'll actually abide by that. But there is a law in place that prohibits legitimate PACs from using or imitating those celebrities. Not using if they are real, but imitating or using technology that will fake that voice.
Well, now with the AI and everything, you can, if they can get some, a celebrity's voice, for example, and turn that into whatever message they want with the quality of the voice.
It is. It's something we talk about oftentimes when we're reaching our audiences to explain how AI is used in a variety of scams to do that. And you only need a small sampling of that voice to make in fake a large conversation or a promotional ad or, as we've seen, a political endorsement.
Yeah. Jonathan in Madison has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Jonathan.
Hello. So I've been getting a lot of these texts from supposedly the USPS, and I know they're not. And as savvy as I thought I was, I did fall for the first one because I was waiting on a package. It was late, like 2 days, and so I got the text like, "Oh, hey, you know, you're short on postage. You need to pay this. You fill out the form." You know, I clicked it, went to a website that looked like the UPS website or USPS. And then, you know, like an hour later, I felt off about it, and I locked the card. And luckily, you know, we have the technology to do that these days. And sure enough, the next day, someone tried to charge it for $300. And, you know, since then, I had read about it, and, you know, I the USPS does not send people texts. And, you know, but I haven't seen any information on anything being done about that. And, you know, I still get the texts all the time, and so do a lot of people I know. And so I was just curious about that.
Yeah, sure. Michelle, do you want to take a crack at that?
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate Jonathan talking about this one. It's what we refer to as a shipping scam. It can come by text. It can come by email, typically, and they want you to click that link to provide that personal information for shipping or that additional postage just so they get that financial information so they can then make that charge later on. And I love that he took those steps. And as far as what's being done about it, anyone who files these complaints and provides us as much information as we can, that is shared with our other state and federal partners. And we do see that through those efforts and combining all that data, that these rings do get broken up from time to time, and actions are taken against these scammers when they can be identified and when they are functioning and acting within the United States. Yeah. Some of these are happening overseas, and so then you're working with our international partners on that. But it does take time, and it takes a lot of effort to whittle them down.
And every once in a while, there's a big success.
Absolutely. We try and announce those when we have them, or the national partner is doing that, and we try and demonstrate those. Some are small one-offs, and others are quite large rings that we've had success with.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Jonathan. Appreciate it. Richard in Madison will give you a chance. Hi, Richard.
Hi. So I have a question in regards to, and I'm maybe just getting direction. So I'm helping some people with some insurance issues on their homes. And there's some insurance companies that are, you know, selling them what they call code coverage, you know, to bring something up to code. And then when you go to try to help them put that through, they suddenly say, no, we're not paying that. And so, I, you know, some of these people are older couples, and I was trying to figure out how do I, where do I direct them to,
yeah,
you know, try to figure out how to get this resolved.
Yeah, it's a good question. Michael?
Oh, Richard, thanks for calling in. I would encourage you to have them call our Office of Commissioners of Insurance in Wisconsin. That's a product that they may be able to have some enforcement authority, regulatory authority over, and help you answer those questions on exactly what it should be done and where you can go if something goes wrong.
Yeah, Office of the Commissioner of Insurance, if I'm is the correct title, I think. Yeah, there you go, Richard. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk at WPR.org. You know, I've never been asked to serve on jury duty, which I always thought it'd be interesting and fun to do, but if you've ever received a jury notice, you know that missing jury duty can come with some real consequences. Apparently, scammers are taking advantage of this. And what's being reported?
Yeah, if you pay attention, if you don't appear for jury duty or respond, I mean, you could face fines, be required to go to court, or in some cases even get arrested. That's pretty extreme. So, of course, scammers are going to take advantage of that as a scare tactic because people want to be in the right with government. And these scammers are going to try and get your money and your sensitive information, that personally identifiable information we ask you to safeguard. And what happens with this scam is usually it starts with that phone call or an email from someone claiming to be a court official or someone from a law enforcement agency, and they say that you've missed jury duty. Well, that's going to set you off into a different kind of panic train of thought, which is going to not allow you to think through things rationally. And so you're not going to realize, I never even got a notice. You know, that's just going to escape your brain there. And that there's this warrant out for your arrest. So now what do I do? You know, that's not a good thing. So the only way to cancel that warrant is to pay a fine or confirm your identity. They're after that personal information because that's what they're going to ask for. They're going to want your social security number and your date of birth. And then if you refuse during that call, they may even threaten you with jail time. And so to make that scam seem even more legitimate, They might give you a fake badge number or a case number in some way. And they may even try and act as though they are a local official, you know, using mm-hmm. that local information from the exchange. So we want people to be able to recognize these scams. And that means that the courts never ask for immediate payment over the phone. No government agency will. So regardless of the type of government scam we're talking about, they don't ask for that payment over the phone. And we really just want to hit that home with people and make sure that that can be remembered. And then only scammers will insist that you can only pay with gift cards, a payment app, cryptocurrency, wire transfers, peer-to-peer sharing apps, those payment apps there. They use those methods because they're really hard to trace and actually recover money from. It disappears quickly. It's like functioning with cash. And so mm-hmm. that's why they want to use that payment method. And that needs to be a red flag for people.
So, and that's a pretty good one if they're asking for money.
Right.
Or your social security number.
Back away. Back away. Just hang up.
Hang up.
No, I mean, if you miss jury duty, there's still some process involved, you know, with that. And well, and these scammers, they remove that process aspect. And so realize it's not that immediate.
They, of course, I've never been asked to serve on jury duty, but I would assume you'd get something in the mail.
You do. I mean, you first get the jury notice in the mail, and then it tells you what you need to do. There's a call in, see if you report. But if you miss and don't do those steps, every municipality or county is a little different in how they process that having missed. But you do get notification, and it's not to make a payment, and it's not a threat immediately. There is, you will need to respond. To the municipality, but it's not in this moment with this phone call.
Mark in Nina has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you doing? How's everybody doing today?
Great. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
I've had several times where my bank has had to cancel my card and give me a different one, and there's already been a charge on it. I'm wondering, how does the bank cover that? Obviously, the bank has paid the charge already, or are they able to get the money back?
Yeah. All right, Michelle.
So he just brings up a great point as to many times his card's been replaced. These credit card companies and banks behind them have really ramped up their fraud departments to identify early irregular activity on someone's cards. And so they will stop transactions midway through if it looks suspicious, call to verify things with you to see if that's legitimately you before they allow those transactions to go through. And when you say no, or they can't get a hold of you, they are stopping those transactions. If they have gone through, some are trying to reverse them as well. But they're so teed up at this point that they're recognizing things before they get to us. And so that's how they are saving some of that money. But it's really helpful if individuals put fraud alerts on their cards so they are monitoring as well to help the banks catch and identify these activities.
Credit card companies are doing it too. I mean, at least my credit card company is right on top of things. I mean, I got a call, and I think I've mentioned this on the show in the past, and I got a call from the credit card company. He said, did you order a $200 necklace and have it sent to Arizona? And I said, nope. And he said, that's what I thought.
Right.
Sure. You know, they have those algorithms and the technology to pick out things that don't match up with your normal spending behavior. But then also the companies recognize some of these known sources to be fraudulent. And Mark gave a good example of how they can preemptively identify one of those known sources and stop it before it gets worse and just issue a new card so they can't.
Yeah. Mark, thank you very much for calling. Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke, our guests from the Bureau of Consumer Protection within our Wisconsin Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Questions for them? We have open lines. Get you on pretty quickly. The number to call is 800 642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke, experts from the Bureau of Consumer Protection for Wisconsin. It's great to have them with us today as we talk consumer protection issues. And you can join in, 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Phil and Marshall emailed to ask if there's any evidence that some of the multitude of political fundraising emails are scams. And I'm guessing the answer to that, Michael, is yes, but maybe not.
I would say yes, there is the evidence. I don't know. I can't provide specific data right now on what those are, but we absolutely know that those scams are out there. And it speaks to exactly why we want to try and get that word out there, being diligent before you donate and before you want to support one of those causes, to make sure you are going to, say, the FEC and checking them to make sure that that organization is registered and your money's going where it should be.
Tom in Woodville has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Well, it's going to take a few minutes if you've got some time. It's about a scam that came across my computer, and they were representing themselves as Microsoft. The lady actually gave me her name and her employee number. I went through a series of questions on the computer. Then she passed me to a person that was supposed to be with the FTC. He gave me his name and his employee number and told me that someone had accessed my information and they were opening bank accounts in my name. So they needed to process something. And he wanted me to take my money out of the bank and put it on a cash card. So I fell for that part of it. And then he told me that he was going to call me back on Monday to get the second. I had another deposit going in. I was going to withdraw that, too. So talking to a few people there, and yeah, this is a scam. So anyway, I talked to a second person that was supposed to be from the FTC, another name and an employee number. Eventually, when I decided this was nothing but a scam, I called the FTC and got a hold of them, and they said that their employees do not give out employee identification numbers. So that was one of the keys there. And she actually took down all the information and all the names and the phone numbers. In fact, the phone number they were using didn't even match the FTC phone number. So this actually came across my screen one more time, and I just eventually deleted it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that story. Michael, comment.
Tom did a perfect scenario of explaining what we're calling kind of a snowballing scam, where it's starting with that one little inception point to get in, and this was a tech support, which is a very common way to get in, and then it just keeps building upon it. You know, we talk about these scams individually, but they're getting more, the scammers are getting more complex and more developed, and they have to, because as you get awareness, you understand what to look for. They have to come at a couple more different angles to try and break down that suspicion. And that's what we saw here, where you're having someone purport to be a legitimate organization that you know does do these things and is there to help you and support you and gives you a phone number you call. But, you know, Tom laid out a few great things. Of one is he talked to somebody else. We want to talk to others and kind of run it by before you take those actions. And as he said, you know, it's a scam, and that's good, and you want to hear that. And then also is not necessarily calling those phone numbers that pop up on your computer, not calling the number that Microsoft is saying it's giving you or the FTC. Go and find a phone number you know is legitimate, like Tom did, and said, okay, you know what, that's not us. But we're starting to see this happen more and more, where these scams are getting building upon each other.
Tom, I'm glad you saved your money there. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Terry in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Terry.
Yeah, hi, Larry. Good morning, and to your guests as well. Larry, recently I discovered that with my Barclay MasterCard, I could add a verbal password along with, you know, a computer password. And I did not realize that with Barclay, I was accumulating like frequent flyer miles, and I had more than a few hundred thousand of those, and got an email one morning that my Air Canada flight in Toronto, the seat was being changed from 18A to 19B. And I've never had any business with Air Canada. So I called them up, and they said, well, somebody purchased a ticket using your frequent flyer miles because we're partners with Barclay, and they looked into their system. Within a period of 6 minutes, these scammers cleaned out my frequent flyer miles from Barclay and bought multiple tickets and apparently sold them to people at a reduced price. At least 7 different tickets from flying out of Canada to other parts of the United States. So when I asked how could this happen, they told me, as a safeguard, add a verbal password to your information and try to change that periodically. And then just recently, within the past couple of days, I got a letter from TD Bank, who I'd never heard of, telling me that they declined issuing me a credit card. And if I wanted to know the reasons to contact them. So I did. I called TD Bank, and they said that they would mail me the information because I wouldn't give them my Social Security number over the phone. Hmm. So those are two instances where these scammers now are getting into your frequent flyer miles, and I have no idea how in the world they got past Barclay to do that.
Boy, oh boy. Terry, thanks for calling. Michelle, you have a reaction?
Yeah, well, I'm going to say it's potentially through a data breach that they got a password. And if you're not changing your password with all the different types of accounts that you have, it's potential they got in that way and realigned things. I mean, there are so many potential opportunities. And he brought up that verbal password, and it makes me think of that multi-factor authentication that we talk about a lot, and setting that up with your emails and your bank accounts and anything that holds that personally identifiable, that sensitive information, putting that deadbolt lock on the front door in addition to the doorknob lock. And that's what multi-factor authentication is, and that can be that verbal password. It can be that token key code that you're going to receive in another form. And so we encourage consumers to do that to safeguard information. And that's what it sounds like that company has encouraged him to do as well.
Yeah, it's great. I use that multi-factor, and I love that because they email me back, and typically they'll email or text me a code.
Mm-hmm.
Just takes a few seconds to get it in there, and there you go. And
absolutely. It's an extra step, and people find it cumbersome, but it isn't cumbersome. It's seconds of time, but yet it protects that data that's behind that password. Doesn't mean you don't update and change your passwords. You
right.
still need to maintain and do that piece, but it puts that extra lock on things, and that can be really important. And having information mailed to you instead of handing over that Social Security number because you want to verify who you're speaking with, that's a great way. I would encourage Terry to go out and check his credit report. Given the impact on different accounts, make sure there aren't some additional extensions of credit and everything's accurate on that credit report, just given there's a couple different locations that have been impacted here.
Yeah, and you can put a credit freeze if you don't have to.
Absolutely.
You can still use your credit cards, but you can put a credit freeze on so nobody can. And then when you need to borrow money, you can unfreeze for a day or whatever and then freeze it back up again.
Yep. If you need that additional credit card or something, you can put that freeze to go through that application process, but you control it. And that's what you want, is as much control as you can have in these situations.
Terry, thank you. I'm sorry for your loss on Air Miles, for sure. Lynn in Hustisford, it's your turn. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. Let me start this off by saying I'm 81 years old.
Okay.
I have a credit card, and I have them had them mail me the invoice every month because it's easier for me to check everything. And I was looking it over, and sure enough, there were 4 charges for Tinder on an invoice. By the way, that's $12.99 a week. And I kind of chuckled at that, and when I called the company and said, this, what the heck is going on here? Because they didn't check. They didn't catch it. And the woman at the other end of the phone also laughed at the fact that I probably was not the person who was going to be using Tinder. So, you know, the long story short is I got a new credit card and I didn't pay the $12.99 times 4.
Well, good for you, Lynn. Michael, she was spot on there.
She was. And one thing that Lynn mentioned is something we always encourage is if you have the opportunity to make payments, if you are legitimately subscribing or signing up for any service, is to try and use a credit card because it does provide that protection that Lynn just mentioned. You can call and let them know, hey, this is fraudulent. It wasn't me. And provides a little bit more of a safeguard.
Yeah. Thank you, Lynn, for that story. Appreciate it. Joe in Madison, your turn. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call. Speaking of safeguards, so I received my recent Medicare statement, and there were some fraudulent charges. You know, I called the Medicare line immediately. They got back to me. I talked to a couple of people, so that's in the works. But a couple of days later, I received a credit alert and, you know, followed that through my credit card company. And so there were some disclosures on the deep web of my Social Security, some of my information. And this all, I think, came about. I was notified by a healthcare company that there was some breach, and so that got out somehow. But so I've frozen my credit. You know, I've signed up for fraud alert. What else can I do? Is there anything else, other steps I should take in an instance like this?
Yeah. Sounds like you've done some good things already. And Michelle, maybe a comment?
Well, I think what Joe's doing is really great. It's monitoring and it's putting safeguards in place where you can. And so the first one as it relates to credit is the credit freeze to lock down your credit, and then a fraud alert so you get notifications. You can put individual alerts on your individual accounts, your individual credit cards and things. But then you're going to want to monitor your statement of benefits, your explanation of benefits when you're using your health insurance. You can ask with those companies if they have any alert notifications that you can put in place. Same with your Social Security statement of benefits. You want to be monitoring that. Now, years ago, I'm dating myself, they used to mail that to you once a year, but now it's an online piece that you can do. There's monitoring you can do with your driver's license through the Department of Transportation and putting alerts on that, making sure that you're first to your mailbox and a scammer's not out there. This all seems like a lot of work and effort, but it's just setting up those best practices, if you will, and then each year analyzing them and seeing which one you can improve upon if you've started to get lax. But also responding when there is a data breach. When you get notified of a breach, act immediately, analyze the data in the breach notification, what has been impacted, and what does that mean I have to do to respond? Do I have to go change passwords because it was a password account? Do I need to just check my credit report because it impacted a Social Security number situation? And you just need to respond accordingly based on the type of information impacted.
Joe, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Let's give Deb in Galesville a chance to join in. Deb, hello. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi. Thank you. Thank you for putting me on. I got a letter from a credit card forgiveness company, and they said they can help me with getting like half of my credit card balance forgiven. I was just wondering if that's a legitimate company or that's a legitimate thing they do, or
we were going to talk. Thank you, Deb. We were going to talk about credit card repair scammers. Is this what we're talking about here?
It is, Larry, and it would be tough to say exactly whether Deb's mail, that promotion that she got there, is legitimate, but there's a couple of things that you'd want to check and make sure you're looking for to help you filter out what's legitimate and what's not, because as we know, there are a lot of legitimate companies that can assist you with some credit repair or get you on a budget to help you bring down those balances. But then there's also the scammers out there that just want to take your money or get some personal information out of you, or kind of promise things that they can't really do. And one of those is, you know, Deb mentioned trying to reduce our balance by half. Another tactic we're seeing is where they're promising to eliminate bad credit ratings or bad credit marks altogether, which they can't do. Legitimate companies can't remove any bad information that is on there from a legitimate source that really was a purchase or a non-payment. For Deb, what I would look for is are they asking you to pay any money up front? And if they are, in order to reduce some of those balances, that should be a red flag, because legitimate credit repair companies can't take that money up front before providing that service. Another is if they warn you not to contact the credit bureau, because they're going to do that transfer of information for you and they'll handle it. They want to keep you isolated with them. That's something you should want to avoid. And then also is if they're asking you to kind of change some information or maybe create a new identity or dispute things that really are legitimate, all of those are telltale signs that is probably a bad actor and you're going to want to steer away from it.
Deb, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Dennis emailed, you should ask court clerks about jury duty. Scammers might figure they'll trick people who have moved recently. If people set up mail forwarding and address changes, jury duty notices could be delayed. It's best to contact the clerk of courts and ask if notices are legitimate. It's probably a good idea.
It is. And as Michelle had mentioned earlier, that some of that changes by municipality and how they issue those notices and who you can call and check. But as a general guideline, Dennis is spot on with saying contact that clerk of courts. If they don't have it, they'll know where to point you. And then verify both whether or not, even if you that initial notice is legitimate, and then, of course, if those missed ones are.
Claire emailed, she's been receiving calls from people claiming they're from Medicare or asking if she has recently received a new Medicare card. Claire presumes the Medicare would not be calling. She's already had her card for a few years. She tells them she is not going to discuss that, and she hangs up and wonders, is this really fraud?
Yeah, Medicare scams are one of the largest imposter scams that are out there, government imposter scams that we see. And we're coming up into open enrollment for Medicare as well. So we anticipate that we'll see a number of different phone calls, text messages, probably mailings, really encouraging people to analyze their benefit choices here. And we want to make sure that you're dealing with Medicare direct. You know, call 1-800-MEDICARE with your questions, report your scams there. But they aren't going to call you.
Yeah.
They don't have the resources or time to call you individually. You don't need to verify who you are by providing your Medicare number. If you were to get a call, they've called you. They should know who you are. You don't have to provide that personal information. And so keep that secure and hang up on those who are contacting you. And you can report those again to 1-800-MEDICARE. And I'm sorry, I don't have those exact numbers that match up with that Medicare.
We can come up with that. We'll come up with that. John in Mount Horeb has something for us. John, hello.
Yes, thank you. I have a question. I hear advertisements on the radio and sometimes on TV about home title fraud insurance. Mm-hmm. And this is talked about supposedly a criminal could file some fake documents with the county and change our home title to their name. And so this home title lock company is trying to sell some service that would prevent that, or insurance that would prevent that. Is this a real threat? And I'd be curious about any comments you have about it.
Okay.
Well, John, thanks for bringing this up. It is a legitimate threat, but it's not a common threat, and it's not something that we see happening frequently because of the complexity required to actually get that title changed into someone else's. And all of this starts with identity theft. And so the core principles of how you want to make sure your identity is protected and those instruments, because in order to achieve this, the criminal has to purport to be you. They have to create fraudulent documents with your personal information. They have to pretend to be you. Maybe that is even in person, going to the local register of deeds. And so I don't know exactly what protections the Home Title Fraud Service provides, but a lot of that can be done by yourself by just making sure you're diligent in your identity and checking on things to make sure. To your question, does it happen? It does happen. But it's not as much of a threat, certainly here in Wisconsin, as we've seen some other states, because we have different laws. And so while you may see, you know, in the news that this is, you know, running rampant in other states, not necessarily in Wisconsin, because there are some protections in place. And you can call your local register of deeds to see if they are providing any services to help prevent any of those transfers of ownership, and see if they also can provide you a little bit more safeguard.
Yeah, there you go, John. Yeah, I think there was the famous... Well, at least it was in the news a lot, which somebody tried to sell Graceland. I think that was... And, of course, when everybody saw that, they said, well, what about my house or right. my place? So, yeah. John, thank you again. Lorraine in Verona, your turn. Hi, Lorraine.
Hi. So my question was, we got an email, and it appeared to be from Best Buy. And what it said was they were going to automatically renew a service for $541, and they would withdraw that from our bank account by debit unless we opted out. And so my spouse did call the number that did appear a little wonky. And then what they said he would have to do is fill out two forms on our computer. And then by then, it's like there was a lot of red flags. And so my spouse hung up. I went to our bank, Summit Credit Union, and said, hey, is somebody going to take out this money in the next 24 hours? And they told us it was a scam. But it was alarming. And
sure.
Yeah, I just thought I'd bring that up.
Yeah, thank you for calling.
Yeah, that's a great one that I hadn't heard of yet. And it's a well-known big box store that's national, so they are impersonated quite regularly. We see that with Amazon and PayPal and Walmart, that they are often targeted for these imposter scams. They give you that threat where you're going to need to take an action, or the company will, that withdrawal, and here's the forms that likely would have asked for all your personal information. So great job recognizing that and disconnecting and then verifying with your bank that no transaction would follow through. Now, on the reverse, you may get, if you are part of an annual membership or service program, yeah. some kind of warranty, a reminder that it's time for renewal, and we're going to automatically debit or charge against your credit card unless you stop, and you get notifications of programs changing. But they already have that, and they're going to say to cancel, log into your account and cancel, and not give you the link. You'll just have to go in and log in as normal. But anytime you're asked to click a link and follow a path, that's when we need you to be concerned, because you're likely going to that imposter site where they're trying to capture your information.
Good information. And let's see, we've already gotten the number for Medicare, the 1-800-MEDICARE or 1-800-633-4227, 800-633-4227. That's the number for Medicare. Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke from the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection's Bureau of Consumer Protection. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Hearing about all kinds of consumer scams on the program today and what you can do about avoiding them with our two guests, Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke from the Bureau of Consumer Protection here in Wisconsin. It's great to have them with us. And join in, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Ginny in DeForest, what can we do for you?
Hello. Yes, I'm curious, if I have all of my accounts frozen, my credit reports, do I have to be concerned about somebody stealing them, and do I have to keep checking those credit reports every month?
Michael?
I think it's always recommended that you be diligent in checking your credit reports just in case for a variety of reasons with new information potentially being compromised. But what your credit freeze does is it stops new lines of credit from being opened. And so while that may be a protection from having new credit cards or loans or refinancing from taking place, there are other ways that your information may be being misused. And so with your credit report, it might show where there was a potential hit and an attempt to open those lines, but then also showing other activity on accounts that you have open right now. So it is recommended that you do check that credit report somewhat frequently to see if there's anything that shows up that shouldn't be, as an additional protective measure to that credit freeze.
Thanks, Jenny, for calling. Tom in La Crosse emailed to ask if you recommend the services that offer identity theft protection, and do they work?
That's a tough one because we don't make recommendations for any company or service. But I will say that you really need to examine them to see what it is that they are going to be providing to you and at what cost. What information do you need to provide to them in order for them to deliver that service, and how will they secure that information? And are you comfortable with that? Because now you've just released your personally identifiable information so they can monitor your information to someone else, and how are they going to secure it to be sure? And really, we're just encouraging people to minimize who you share your information with overall. But then what is that protection that they're providing to you? Because we've certainly seen some companies that have said that they'll do this, but then to actually get them to engage in the insurance aspect, there needs to be this hard and fast line that the breach happened and you were impacted in this way in order to get that coverage. So will you really be getting what you think you're purchasing? So check it out. Make sure that company doesn't have complaints or any misreps, and always check them out in the same way you would engage in any other service.
Frank in Belmont, your turn now. Hi, Frank.
Hi there. I get a lot of phone calls from my doctors and insurance companies, which usually are okay. I'm sure that they are who they say they are, but I still don't want to do this stuff. They ask me who I am and want me to give them my social to be sure I am who I am, and that's good. There is HIPAA out there to protect me. What I'd like to do is tell them, yes, I will. I will tell you the first character is 3. You tell me the next one, and we'll go down the line through all of the characters. That way I'm sure who they are, and I'm sure who I am.
Ah.
I think Frank pointed out a really great point on how we want to try and control the flow of the information. If they're calling you and they want you to verify, if they're a legitimate organization who does have an account with you or providing services, they're going to have that information. So as you mentioned, you know, verifying character by character. Another is having them tell you what information they have on file, and then you can, of course, confirm that with them. Now, is that necessarily going to allow them to confirm you are who you are? If you're just saying yes, I understand it's difficult, but it also it's becoming more and more rare for companies to actually ask for your social security number over the phone. And so if you're receiving that phone call and they're asking that, and hopefully some of those red flags are going up, we would encourage everyone, if there is, just hang up and then call back at call the company you know, call that organization, call the doctor, call the insurance company directly, and then say, hey, I got a phone call. I was a little suspicious. I just want to verify what you need, and then go ahead and provide what they need at that point.
Yeah. On the medical side, I think in my own case, they have some personal questions. Mm-hmm. As a check, and they'll ask me to select from answers, and if you know, select the right answers, you know they know it's me. Mm-hmm. And I think that's another way that you could companies operate to sort of help protect without having to give a social security number. Paul in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Paul.
Hi, I had some experience with a fake website. I had problems with my Canon printer, and I went to Canon website, And there was a phone number. I pressed, you know, started on the phone tree, and after one button push, I got a person, which probably should have been my warning, because you never get a person on the first button.
No.
But I talked to some tech help, and went through a lot of rigmarole, and finally he said, well, you've got malware in your router, and we can sell you some security software for $300. And at that point, I hung up. I knew it was a scam. And I went back and checked, and sure enough, there was a slight alteration to the website address, but it was a very convincing fake.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, Michael, that's the case often with these websites. They can be really close.
You hit on it. They're very convincing. They're darn near identical replicas of the legitimate website. And as Paul noted, you have to pay attention to the small things, those little details of what might give you away of, okay, with Canon, you know, maybe one of those O's is a zero. And if you're just quickly looking at it, you're not going to notice that you're going too different. Also to pay attention is when you're doing a search, is making sure that just because it pops up at the top, that it may not be the first legitimate organization. The scammers can also prioritize where their website gets listed and how it gets organized and how it displays and the wording that it's used to convince all of us consumers that that must be the real legitimate one. And in fact, it isn't. And it's not just private companies. We've seen government organizations also fall for it, where sometimes even a legitimate company prioritizes themselves above the real government organization. And then unfortunately end up paying maybe additional fees or other things. So it's not just always scammers trying to steal information or money. It's sometimes a business that is kind of doing things a little bit shady.
Yeah. Paul, thank you very much. Jay and Tomahawk, your turn. Hi, Jay.
Hey, good morning. And thank you guys so much for having this conversation. I think it's absolutely critical. So bottom line, I've got a cautionary tale. I'm a licensed financial representative for one of the larger financial firms in the nation, and I work with clients all over the nation. And had a client who approached us to take out their entire retirement savings, which we did, and she gave us a reason for it, which sounded legitimate to all parties involved. However, what she failed to share with us was she had received a letter on company letterhead that instructed that she was the victim of fraud. And in order to mitigate these fraud, you know, this fraudulent activity, she needed to remove all her funds, call this number, and they answered as if they were the organization, and transfer the funds to, you know, to another third party. And unfortunately, she was completely lost. You know, the lesson learned there is obviously, especially with folks with retirement savings, you've developed relationships with people you know that are in the financial firm, financial field. Trust them. Communicate with them. If you get a letter like this, don't walk. Run to your local branch. Give them a call. Tell them exactly what you got, and we can help you navigate, because had she informed me that this was the reason for it, we would have immediately put safeguards on her funds, and she still would have her retirement savings. Mm. But thank you guys for doing this.
All right, Jay, thanks. Michelle, a comment?
Yeah, I love that Jay called in. Thank you for doing that and speaking of it from that perspective, because we get into situations where consumers want to control their funds, but then they also think that there's some responsibility for the banks and others to stop some of these transactions. And that's not always the case. They can ask questions, and we really encourage consumers to share their stories with people they trust. And don't keep things a secret just because the scammer has asked you to do so. Have that conversation, do some verification, trust your gut as well. It doesn't always make a lot of sense to remove all your money from a particular account in order to secure it, you know, put it over here instead. But we lose that rational train of thought when these scammers are threatening us or putting fear into us because someone's in danger or our money's at risk. And so we have to have conversations. And I'm glad Jay is a trusted person for individuals.
Jay, thank you so much for calling. We are talking scams, of course, today with our guests, Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke from the Bureau of Consumer Protection for Wisconsin. And they'll be with us right up till 12:30 today. At 12:30, we're going to take a look at efforts here in the state to improve internet access in Wisconsin. But right now, consumer protection, the issue, you can call at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. And we'll be back right after the news. We're taking a look at consumer scams on the program right now with our two guests, Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke from the Bureau of Consumer Protection for DATCAP. It's great to have them with us as they come by every couple of months to deal with issues. And you can join in at 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Marie in Eau Claire will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Marie.
Hi. Say, I belong to a small group of tutors, and every 3 years we have to do a background check, and we get a link, and we kind of hit the link, and then you just answer a few questions. That's generally how it works. But this year, when I opened mine, it took me to a permission page to allow a fairly elaborate credit check and then use of my credit information. So I am assuming that that is not part of a standard background check, and none of my fellow employees have that portion in their background check link.
I'm
just wondering, thoughts?
I'd go to the company.
I was going to suggest the same thing. I would double check that and reach out to the company that's asking for the background check and make sure that you got an accurate link, because especially if your peers aren't getting the same request and are asking for the same information, and this is also different from what you've previously been providing, I would turn that around and reach out and verify first.
Yeah. Human resources, personnel department or whatever of your own company. I think it was it from her own company where she works?
I think it's for the tutor group, yeah.
The tutor group, yep.
There you go, Marie. Check it out. Thank you for calling. Laurel in Brooklyn, your turn. Hi, Laurel.
Hi. If this was Crohn's disease, a lot would be being done about it. And I don't, Why aren't these questions answered with call this state agency? Because we track those things. And there's, you know, having people on the job to do it. Why is it always, if somebody's handbag is grabbed, we don't say, well, you got to chase after that guy.
Well, I think Laurel's asking what type of law enforcement is in charge of scams when people get scammed. I mean, are there police departments? But really, consumer protection and other departments do this, right, Michael or Michelle?
Yeah, absolutely. So consumer protection efforts and chasing down these scammers is a collaborative effort for sure at the local, state, and federal international governments. We are working together across state agencies to identify what scams are out there that consumers are experiencing, and cracking down where we can, and the Federal Trade Commission, the Federal Communications Commission, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Homeland Security, the U.S. Postal Inspection Service, they are all part of our efforts. The IC3 is on top of things when you report there, that they are immediately analyzing that data and trying to respond to issues of immediate nature. So we're all working together. But because some of these are international in nature or they are difficult to track, we need consumers as part of that partnership to report and try and be diligent. And when we know the signs and red flags and symptoms, to stop efforts of these scammers as well.
Yeah. There you go, Laurel. Thank you. Joan in Madison, your turn. Hi, Joan.
Hi. I am wondering about an organization to which I have given, but I've recently seen Facebook posts that have been saying that there's fraud going on with this organization. And the name of the organization is ActBlue. They collect for Democratic purposes or the Democratic Party, and I've always trusted it. Do you know anything about whether it's untrustworthy?
It's a nonprofit fundraising platform, and I think it was founded back in 2004, from what I gathered. So the thing is, I don't know if you know. I'm assuming it's a legitimate organization, but there could be people misrepresenting it too.
Yeah, I'm not specifically familiar with ActBlue, but what I would recommend Joan do is go to the Federal Election Commission and check their website. And any registered organization who's doing exactly what she mentioned and soliciting for campaigns is required to register there. And that'll also give specifics not only about that particular organization, but also their leadership, contact information. And so if she wants to follow up on that to specifically ask questions about what those concerns are, she knows where to go with them.
And again, where would she go?
The Federal Election Commission, which is FEC.gov.
FEC.gov. There you go, Joan. Please do check and see what's going on. Bob in Sun Prairie will go to you. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Larry. I don't know, this isn't really security-related question, I guess, but I'm wondering, when my phone rings and it says, the phone recognizes that it's spam, a spam risk, it comes up, spam risk, then why can't they make the phone not ring if it knows that it's spam risk?
Yeah, so this goes back to federal legislation that was passed in December of 2019, I believe, and it's called the TRACED Act, and it permits these telecommunications providers to label, and more than permits, it requires that they try and authenticate phone numbers that are going through and inform consumers of that, but they still have to permit the calls to go through depending upon the layer of authentication that's being done. And there's concerns of risk of not letting phone calls go through, because what if there's an error in that someone you need to speak with? And so they're at least giving you best information for you to make decisions as to engaging with that phone call. So you can also set different blocks with your phone itself to increase that level of call blocking, if you will, or masking and labeling. So the provider's doing its level of marking, and now within your phone you can do that, and then there's also apps that you can add a third layer of identification there.
Thank you, Bob. Appreciate it. Mike in Cross Plains wanted to know if password management software is a good idea, and if so, are the free ones safe?
Well, it's tough to say which ones are safe and which ones, and as we mentioned, we don't either recommend or discourage any particular platform because we don't know enough about them. But as we've grown more and more adept to having to have different passwords for so many things and and it's such a large online presence, it's almost becoming unavoidable to not have a password manager. And so what we want to do is just encourage everyone to certainly do their research before signing up. You know, sometimes reviews and ratings, while we know they might be, can be tailored to a certain level, but we want to make sure that you're looking out for what are the reliable ones, which ones have a long history, which ones have a lot of users. Do that research. And then if you find one, it may not be free, it may cost a little bit, but there are ones that are valuable. And you know, it certainly makes it a lot easier to try and make sure you're using different passwords for each website, protecting yourself a little bit more.
You folks have recently received a good number of reports from people who were targeted by PayPal scams. What kinds of requests are people getting from scammers?
Well, we've received these calls from consumers. It's a different twist on the old scam. So we've always talked about the phishing attacks that come using PayPal as information. But we're also hearing from them about fake invoices that consumers are receiving. And with that, what's happened is that the consumers describe receiving invoices and money requests through PayPal from people that they don't recognize about purchases that they didn't even make. And in the scam, the requester sometimes includes a note that they hope will pressure you into sending money right away. In other cases, they're going to send you an invoice designed to look like a legitimate message. And we even see some where they're providing you with a customer service phone number that really just connects you to the scammer itself. They're using this new variation to try and get money from you to pay this fake invoice. Also, personal information like that bank account number or account login details, because they're going to want you to click those links. They're using that tactic of urgency, alarm, you know, that you have an outstanding invoice. Nobody likes that. But please just pause, think through the situation. If you at all think it's legitimate, log into PayPal. See if there's an outstanding invoice. See if there's something, a message for you there through your normal login mechanism. And go to PayPal's official website as opposed to any links that you might click or any direction that this email may give you. But it's just another phishing scheme that's got a new twist and variation trying to get people to act and react to it.
Renee in Madison has a question for you or a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Renee.
Hi. I'm just calling. We ended up getting this information saying Change Health, there was a big breach of our information, my daughter, my son, me, my husband, and they were saying our data was breached, and I didn't know if this was legit, and it turns out it was on yesterday on NPR that I guess Unity Health ended up, I don't know, it was a corporate sellout or something that merged, and information was, I guess they didn't do it correctly or they did it cheaply, and the information was breached and the security was lapsed. And so now I have this information that they sent me, and so I was a little nervous if it was legit, and then I called, and she said Change Health is like a third party that if you had a prescription, they pay, or they go, they do the paying, and so I have all this information, and I want to make sure that my I can protect my information. So I didn't know if this all this information was legit, but then I started hearing it on the radio. So I don't know what our next step should be.
You should, I would think you'd want to call directly the healthcare, whatever hospital or whatever company you... Wouldn't that make sense?
No, and she's done this great due diligence. She's verified things. She's heard something, you know, on NPR, so it's out there in the media. She's called, it sounds like, the health provider and done verification and understood that this is a third party associated with. So in this merger, something didn't transaction properly, and there has been this breach. Now, often they're going to offer you monitoring services as part of the breach, and this letter may explain that. And if they've validated that the letter is legitimate, your legitimate notification of the breach, then you can feel confident with the information in the letter and decide if you want to take advantage of those monitoring services if they are providing them. But then things we've talked about on the program today are things that you can do individually to also monitor. You want to analyze what type of data has been compromised. Is it financial? Is it your social security number, just bank accounts, and or just your health
or
data?
Or your mother's maiden name? Or
security questions, right. And so then how does that impact other things? We'll help you set up that. And you can call Consumer Protection. It dawns on me, we haven't given that number out once today, but you can call Consumer Protection to ask questions and have information sent to you as to how to do this monitoring. And you can reach us at 1-800-422-7128 or go to our website at datcp.wi.gov. And we have fact sheets for individuals on how to set up that security freeze, how to do monitoring if you've been impacted by a breach. But you can also look to see about data breaches that we're aware of, because we post those on our website. So you can sometimes validate that a breach is legitimate through our website.
Renee, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. October is cybersecurity month, if I'm not mistaken. And what kind of information do you need to think about protecting? I think we've talked a lot about it over the course of the show. But what are some good basic preventive measures to keep your information safe online? And we've covered a lot of them, but
we have covered a lot of them, and we use Cybersecurity Awareness Month as a reminder to everyone to think about those basics and think about things we kind of take for granted or skip over or maybe feel like aren't useful any longer. And in reality, they really are. And it's about making sure we're looking at our routines, looking at our habits, and changing them if need be, or maintaining the ones that are good habits. And a couple of those are, first, updating the software regularly. We see those little notifications come up to say that's a new update, and sometimes we get scared or don't want to do it because it's going to change what it looks like, and sometimes we're creatures of habit and don't like that, but it's really necessary that you do install those updates, because not only do they make some enhancements, but they resolve bugs and they patch holes to security risks. And when those are identified, the bad actors also know about them. So you want to make sure you patch those up so your device doesn't get compromised. Another is creating those strong passwords, but it's emphasizing that you want different strong passwords for every account. Well, the reason we say is we've talked today about data breaches, and once, you know, if you're using the same login and the same password, if that's compromised once, these bad actors can kind of run across other platforms and see where else you're using it. And if you're using it across, you know, many different ones, it's going to give them access to get into all those other accounts. So, you know, if your Facebook account is hacked, all of a sudden they're going to have access to anything that's tied with those same usernames and passwords. And the other is multi-factor authentication. We've talked about it, and sometimes we hear, well, it's kind of a pain, but in reality, it's just a couple seconds. But it provides such a higher level of security. And Michelle mentioned earlier, it was a great analogy of it. That's the deadbolt on the door. You know, you may want to click just a little hand knob, but putting that deadbolt in adds a level of security that's very difficult to get into. And that's what multi-factor authentication does. And then lastly is recognizing those phishing attempts. A lot of the calls we took today are really start with phishing, and it's just casting it out there to see who's going to respond. You know, the first one we called, we started with the shipping scam, and these scammers recognize that, you know, millions of people are shipping things every day. And so if they just toss that all out there, there's a chance that someone is going to react to it.
A question from John. How are companies collecting your data online? How can you limit control what information you're sharing?
Boy, that's a tough question to answer. So they collect all sorts of different kinds of data online depending upon what you're providing. So if you engage with a company online and you purchase something, there's your banking information, maybe just your credit card, but it might also be your account information and who are their affiliates and how do they interact and what data do they share. And you can see that through privacy policies. And no one likes to read those, and they're very long, and who knows if you can even understand them. But that's going to indicate whether or not they share that data, who those affiliates are, and then they may have affiliates and what happens. So that's different types. But they may also track your browsing history. So what are your interests? And that's the cookies that are out there, and not the yummy kind that you bake at home, but your computer cookies, and making sure that, you know, all of a sudden you're getting these targeted ads for a particular kind of shoe. That's because they're tracking that data history, and now you have target marketing. But that, in combination with your personal data, they start setting up these profiles, and maybe they understand your interests, and some of it's marketing, but some of it's scammers pieced together and know how to put twists and turns into things as well, in order to target you for particular scams.
Yeah. I think about, I bought a pair of shoes online, and now that was about 6 years ago, and I still get information about those same shoes, and I keep saying, well, I already bought those.
Right. Well, the one story I'll share is I had a pretty clean profile there for a while, and I filled out one survey, and I thought it was from a pretty trusted source, but it was really from a trusted source's affiliate, and now the number of different scam and spam emails that I get is so incredibly large and disappointing. And, you know, so you have to be careful of those contests, opportunities, surveys, warranty cards, all of that that you are filling out and handing over information about yourself that might seem really innocent, or it's to win that grand vacation because it's with a company you do business with, but what's behind it?
One last thing, and we can spend a minute or two on it. Moving in, moving out, we talked about this a little bit on the show in the past, but and another show recently, but working with your, you know, moving in, moving out, working with your landlord, what should you do before with that, Michael?
Well, you talked about the relationship, and that's one of the key elements that we always try to encourage, is making sure you have that good relationship with the landlord or with your tenant, depending on which side you're on of that relationship. But there's kind of three stages of it, that, you know, that's moving in, moving out, and then the actual moving itself. And we really want to focus on tips before you're moving in. And that is paying attention to exactly what the lease requires and what your responsibilities are going to be in it when you're the tenant and moving in, and making sure that you understand what utilities you're going to have to pay for and what the landlord is going to cover. Or if you're splitting the residence, and you have to understand what is your percentage going to be and are you comfortable with that. Next is making sure you understand when you're going through and looking at all of the disclosures being made, is everything in working order? Is everything that they've said that they're going to fix or repair to put it in a condition where you want it to be? And then also getting copies of those things. Understanding also when you move out that what their responsibility is to return that security deposit. Oftentimes we get a lot of complaints about security deposits, and sometimes this just has the education of understanding a landlord has 21 days to return that security deposit. But it's also important to recognize that that tenant needs to provide their mailing address and where to go. So the landlord needs, you know, where am I going to send it? And sometimes when those relationships break down and that tenant doesn't want to tell where they're going, well, that makes it difficult for them to send that payment. So it's important that they recognize that. And then also, we just want to finish with that, the check-in sheet. You know, there's a check-in and a check-out, and really making sure both the landlord and the tenant are having that done, because it protects both sides. And so make sure that we both agree what the condition is of that unit when you're moving in, and then you move out, is verifying that it's in that same condition. And what if there is any discrepancies, you know, that's what the security deposit is for, and you agree upon what that might be. So we have a great checklist on our website. We have some great resources, a landlord-tenant guide and our tenant rights and responsibilities literature to help make sure you have a good experience doing that. And that can be found at datcp.wy.gov.
And just one final thing. I know we've had some terrible hurricane issues, and there's some scam possibilities out there. In the last minute, maybe you can fill us in, Michelle.
Yeah, absolutely. We want to make sure everyone is just on the lookout for any Hurricane Helene scams that may be forgiving, to help support those who've been impacted by that. Just remember all those charity tips, charity giving tips we've talked about in the past. Check out that organization at give.org, charitynavigator.org, or the Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions before giving, or give directly to those organizations' websites that you know and trust on a national basis by going there directly yourself, as opposed to responding to any social media posts, text messages, or emails that you may get. We want that money that you may have to be able to support these individuals to get to those organizations and not the scammers. So just be on guard for that.
On that note, Michael, Michelle, thank you both so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. We'll look forward to your next visit.
That sounds great.
Thanks,
thank
Larry.
You.
Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke from the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Great to have them with us, and they'll be back probably in a couple months, and we'll do it all over again. Coming up, we're going to take a look at broadband access in Wisconsin and what's being done for those areas that maybe don't have it or poor broadband access. I'm Larry Mueller.
Broadband internet is becoming a necessary part of a community's infrastructure, but some places in Wisconsin don't have access. Larry Mueller here. You're listening to WPR News. We're talking about the work being done to improve broadband across our state. And our guest today is Alyssa Kenny. She is the Wisconsin Broadband and Digital Equity Director for the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin. And as we talk with Alyssa, I hope you'll join in. Do you have broadband in your area? How's it helped your community? Is it not good? What has broadband meant for your business? You can reach us at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Alyssa Kenny, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here and talk about broadband.
So what's happening with broadband internet across Wisconsin?
I'm so glad you asked. It's a very exciting time. You know, for the past 4 years, Governor Evers has really made broadband investments a priority. And we've seen the both state and federal funding for broadband expansion grow just exponentially over the last 4 years. And so we've had hundreds of millions of dollars of investment, and we have a lot of projects going on right now. And then with the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act, we had an additional huge amount of federal funding allocated to the state of Wisconsin to really help get us to fully that internet for all and universal service. And so we have a bunch of state projects that are in progress and connecting people every day. And then we have a lot of federal money coming to really finish the job and get internet to everyone.
Yeah, that's great. So how many areas, or are there certain areas of Wisconsin that really lack broadband internet?
Boy, you know, every single county in the state of Wisconsin has some locations that need improved service. You certainly see, you know, north of Highway 10 and in southwestern Wisconsin, some slightly higher concentrations. But broadband and high-speed internet is just, it's not distributed equally. And sometimes you can have one side of the road with great broadband and the other side of the road not connected. And so those locations are really sprinkled throughout, but certainly where the population gets a little sparse, it tends to have less good internet.
So, and here I probably should have asked this right away, but we got an email from Clarice. What is broadband internet?
That's a great question. And so broadband's definition has actually, I've just been in this job for 5 years and the definition has changed. And the state definition and the federal definition also are even a little different. And so that generally when people are talking about broadband, they're talking about a certain speed and then a certain thing called latency, which is kind of like the lag you might see. And so often now what people use as the standard is 100 megabits down and 20 megabits up. But what I really like to say is broadband is, it's the internet people need to fully participate in digital society. And that might be changing over time, but it's really a connection that's not just adequate, but substantial to do the types of things that everyone's doing online, whether that be shopping or telemedicine or participating in school on a snow day. If you need it to do those things, it's broadband.
So what are the different ways that broadband is delivered to homes?
Right. So there's you know, sort of three big categories. One category is called wireline. And so that's most often we see fiber or cable, or people might have many years ago used DSL or copper lines, sort of a phone line. And so that's an actual physical wire that goes from a residence or a business and connects to the internet. And then there's a lot of folks who use fixed wireless, and that that looks a lot like a cell phone service, but it comes from a tower to a radio to the home. But unlike a cell phone service, it's not designed to be mobile. It's designed to just serve that single location. And then there's people in the state who have satellite service. And so that's getting their internet from a satellite way up in the sky. And that service tends to be both the most expensive and have the highest issues with kind of quality and latency and data caps.
Maybe we should talk a bit about the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin. Maybe talk more about it and what you're responsible for.
Sure. And so maybe I could say that the Wisconsin Broadband Office, we live at the Public Service Commission. We are on the same team as the people who do telecommunications work. But broadband is not regulated. It is the state has sort of no authority to control the pricing. We don't, we can't require a certain internet service provider to provide us information, or we can't require them to build in a certain location or serve certain customers. And so largely what we do in the state is we administer grant funds to really drive broadband deployment in areas of the state where there's underserved or locations that either have no broadband or they have really inadequate internet and need improvements. And so one of the biggest things we do is administer funds to providers who are building where it's most needed. The other thing we do is a lot of mapping and community building, because the data around broadband is getting much better, but there's been a lot of challenges. And so a key function of our office is to really map exactly where broadband is so we can be really precise in where we deploy any funding to get it better.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. Alyssa Kenny, our guest today from PSC of Wisconsin. She leads the broadband and digital equity for the Public Service Commission. Great to have her with us. And questions, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Randy in La Crosse, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Oh, well, thanks. Well, I got in right away. I grew up in Minnesota, and I know that Minnesota passed a law. I don't know if it's still in effect, but it banned municipalities from doing their own internet, which St. Paul was talking about doing. And I know that Chattanooga, Tennessee has one of the best internet services in the country. It's also fairly cheap, and it's owned by the city. And I know a bunch of different states have passed laws that you can't do it. I don't know if Wisconsin has done that. And if they haven't done that, why not put some money into locally owned internet services instead of being gouged by the big boys?
All right, Randy, you raised some issues there. Alyssa, what about it?
Right, so Wisconsin does have some statute and some rules on the books that make it difficult, but not impossible for a municipality to become an internet service provider. And so I think you would put us in the category of a state that has some barriers. States need to complete a study. They need to provide some notice. And so it is not easy necessarily for a community to just decide to become an internet service provider. That said, the federal funding that's coming to the state, municipalities are an eligible entity. And I would say what we've seen in Wisconsin increasingly that's been really successful is a public-private partnership model where the local community or the local government really gets involved in driving the scope of the project, works closely with an internet service provider on making sure things like fire stations and public safety answering points have redundancy and really sufficient connections. And maybe they put even in some local dollars, but they really work in a partnership. And so we've seen not a lot of municipal broadband in the state, but we have seen some really strong public-private partnerships where the local community really has a little bit of a voice in the project and creates some accountability and drives the scope of those projects.
Randy, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. James in Fountain City will go to you. Hi, James.
Hi. Say, thanks for my call. We are getting, I live semi-rural south of Fountain City. We're getting fiber optic lines run. They're in the process right now. In the funding that took place on this, because we had some public meetings we went to, it's being provided by, well, the Cochrane Telephone Company. It's a private entity. But we are being charged. I mean, you know, the federal government supplied some funding for this.
Mm-hmm.
But we are being charged individually as homeowners for the remainder of this. And, you know, I mean, I'm comparing apples to oranges here, but I have friends that live up 12 miles south of Bemidji. They're way out in the boondocks, and they have a telephone cooperative that ran fiber optic lines to their house with no charge whatsoever. Mm. You know, a monthly charge for the use of it, obviously, but no charge for installation. And we're getting nailed for all this installation stuff. And I'm just curious, how is that determined who pays for these installation charges?
Okay, Alyssa, comment?
Yeah, those sort of installation charges, and also I would say what a standard installation might be, they vary company by company. And sort of as I mentioned, it's unregulated. And so different, these are largely businesses or co-ops. They choose their own policies. And we see in the state of Wisconsin a lot of what I would consider kind of line extension problems, where people with exceptionally long driveways, they might even be passed by internet, but the cost to get up their long driveway is very high. And some providers, they all sort of have their own installation cost policies. I will say largely the Public Service Commission, when we fund grants, we kind of do fund to the property, but not necessarily all the way to the home. We let whatever the provider's standard installation policy that they would provide to any other customer would stand for any Public Service Commission grant also. But there's an incredible amount of variability about what different providers do and how they manage those installation costs, and particularly in communities with long driveways, or maybe in your case, Granite Bluffs and other beautiful Wisconsin geography.
Yeah, there you go, James. Thank you so much for calling, appreciate it. You can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. You can talk with Alyssa Kenny, who leads broadband and digital equity for the PSC of Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking broadband access in the state of Wisconsin with Alyssa Kenny, who leads broadband and digital equity for the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin. Great to have Alyssa with us. And again, join in with your own questions or comments. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Kim emailed. She has a second home in northern Wisconsin in Oneida County, just north of Rhinelander. There's no broadband or high-speed internet available in that area. She'd love to work from home there and potentially move there, but she can't without that internet connection. And she just wonders when they might have broadband in that area in Oneida County, just north of Rhinelander.
That's a great question. So I will say I hate to tell people who just told me they don't have great internet or they have no internet. We do have a great map on the commission website called the Broadband Grant Footprint, where you can see if your location has funding and what the expected completion date. And so one thing is just to check, because as I started with, there are a lot of open projects in this state, and there's a tremendous amount of investment in construction and growth right now. And so there are a lot of locations that don't, about 200,000 locations that we know of that are getting broadband in the next few years. You know, they have a contract, they have a grant, they're they're building. And so maybe your home is in that location and you know. Additionally, we have those federal funds. They're called those BEAD dollars as part of Internet for All. And those are really designed to get the state to every location. I do want to mention broadband takes a while, and federal dollars and large grants, the administration. So these will not come, you know, people will not have connections from these new federal dollars in a year or two. It will take 4 years probably to really fully award all those dollars and build out all that broadband. These are both big projects, and they're really in some of our remotest and hardest to serve areas of the state. And so, unfortunately, or fortunately, broadband is all connected. And so you tend to get to the hardest locations last, because that's just how network building goes.
Reminds me of everything from electricity, where the rural areas were kind of the last to get the electricity, and telephones service way back in the day. And these things take time to build out, as you say. Linda in Delavan, your turn. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that I live in a rural part of Walworth County in Delavan. And in Whitewater, there is now a company called Edge, and they are providing fiber optic all over this county. And I think a couple other counties, and they are phenomenal. You can call them. You actually get to talk to a person. And they did not charge any installation fee, and they have three different plans, and they're all affordable. I just want to give a shout out to them, and if anybody has the option, use them.
And the name of the company again?
Edge.
Edge.
E-D-G-E. Yes, they're great.
Oh, Alyssa, comment.
You know, what a great comment, and I love to hear. And I will say there are over 112 internet service providers in the state of Wisconsin. So you see sort of the big main carriers that you're used to, that you might get telephone service from. But there are many small providers that are providing fiber to the home, that are providing, you know, co-ops. And so we do have a lot of providers. And so I always really encourage folks to look through all their available options and not, you know, and compare the prices. And I'm so glad to hear you're having such a positive experience with that provider.
Julie in the town of Primrose emailed, she lives in rural southwest Dane County. Her internet is 4 down and 1 up. She said, yes, that's right. The irony of that is TDS, her provider, ran high-speed internet cable in the easement along their property, and when asked if it meant she'd be getting high-speed internet, she was told that it was just to get the high-speed internet from one town to another. Any chance there will be improvement in the southwest Dane County anytime soon?
You know, I can't speak to particular locations, but we really are moving towards that internet for all in the state. We have 200,000 locations in progress. We have federal funding for kind of that final 200,000. And so it is coming. We hear this type of complaint quite a bit, though, where folks, basically it's like a middle mile, the internet's running right by their house, but it's not a residential service. It's sort of like a long haul or a long run piece. And it's so frustrating to have the internet, as somebody said, so close you can smell it, but not have it delivered to your house. And that's about sort of network design. And I'm sorry, but I do hope it's coming. And even places like Dane County have thousands of locations that still need service.
Yeah. Jane emailed. She lives out in the county south of Sun Prairie and east of Easttown, and Spectrum upgraded it to 5G several months ago, installed a new cable line to the house, and a new TV receiver. And since then, her internet's been slower. And her TV pixelates at random times. She's wondering, why is it slower than 4G? And that might have something to do with her own equipment that she has in the house.
That could definitely be a possibility, that something needs to be updated. But I would definitely say reach out directly to your provider and, you know, do the technical help ticket and do what you can to to improve that.
Yeah, because if the equipment you have, the TV or whatever you have in your house, isn't quite a bit have the ability to handle 5G, I could see where that might be a problem. But yeah, you're right. It's worth it definitely to talk to somebody from the company. Are there benefits, or if there are benefits? I'll see. This is really worded weird. So I'm going to. What are the benefits to fiber optic internet over standard internet service?
Sure. So fiber optic is threads of glass. So it's internet that travels at the speed of light, whereas some other internet might be traveling at the speed of sound. It tends to be the internet that sort of is what people might call future-proof or has like a much longer lifespan. So it's not going to, it needs sort of less repair potentially, or it doesn't sort of go out of, it's just a lot more upgradable. So fiber is, you know, it's actually becoming the standard in many, many places. It's what most people are installing now when anything new is coming. And so it's in some ways a sort of preferred, more future-proof thing, but it's often in the state of Wisconsin is buried along the road. And so there are places where populations are too sparse, or there's wetlands or cranberry bogs or things that are really important where a different technology like fixed wireless or even satellite might be most appropriate.
Yeah, that makes sense too. Eric in Lincoln County, what's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. Being a normally suspicious person and dealing with corporations, I always wonder, when we're always talking about tax dollars and grants and how our tax dollars are supporting this infrastructure, what kind of responsibility these corporations have? And they have no problem putting in cellular in a city or a town that has multiple locations all close together. But, you know, in the old days, it didn't take long to electrify the whole country, and broadband really has the importance now of what electricity back in the day, since you can't do anything financially or otherwise without broadband.
So, yeah, yeah. Okay, thank you, Eric. Comment, Alyssa?
Sure. So I will say we are incredibly strict in the locations that we provide funding for. So we make extra sure that we are providing dollars and public dollars, and I would say only to locations that really don't have service. So we're not funding where there's existing service or there's options for folks or the internet's sufficient. We're really putting those public dollars in just to places that are really not having service. And then additionally, we're not necessarily funding the whole network, because we know that this is a business that will charge customers eventually. We're trying to fund only the part of it that's going to get them to kind of meet their business model or to sort of get to a commercially viability, just like rural electrification, maybe a little different than rural electrification. So we are really careful about where we put those public dollars. We hold those providers incredibly accountable for every penny they spend. We look at all their expenses and reimburse only for those locations. And we really try to drive the dollars where public dollars are needed to get the investment in those communities.
Yeah. By the way, the broadband map, how do people find that map? I went on to it and I thought it was very useful and easy to use.
So go to that, our Public Service Commission website, and then you've got to choose broadband and then our map. And we have a number of really great mapping resources, a planning map for local communities, a Wisconsin broadband map for people to see their service. They are a bit technical and they are online, but they're really, they're nice if people want to understand some of the many exciting things happening with broadband in the state.
Well, I'm glad that we're putting a lot of effort into this, Alyssa, and I want to thank you for your work and for being with us today. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a great opportunity.
Alyssa Kenny leads broadband and digital equity for the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin. Go online to the PSC and look up that map. And there's other information in there as well. Thanks so much for listening. And a big thanks to our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. And our executive producer, by the way, is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Again, thank you for listening and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.